Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
Season 5, Episode 3 of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Redcon One, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another week of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. We are talking about the NABBA Mr. Universe contest with this season, and it is a very prestigious and historic competition that took place in London, England, every fall from beginning in 1950 all the way up to the present time. But during the time of its run, it had some of the greatest bodybuilders in the history of the world competing and winning that competition, including Bill Pearl, Reg Park, John Grimmick won the very first one in 1948 before it was called the NABBA Universe, Steve Reeves, of course, the great Arnold Schwarzenegger, Frank Zane, Boyer Coe, Chris Dickerson, and many, many others. Today on the show, we have Boyer Coe himself, one of the greatest bodybuilders of the 1960s, 70s, 80s. Boyer had a really long career. He started off in the AAU, and then he won the NABBA Universe, I think, three times. And then he had a great career in the IFBB, competing in the Mr. Olympia contest, and he was always right up there. He competed in the 1980 Mr. Olympia with Arnold. So Boyer's got a great career. He won the Mr. America contest in 1969 and then went right over to the Mr. Universe that year and was fortunate enough to win the overall amateur Mr. Universe in 1969. So Boyer's always one of my favorite interviews because he's got some great stories to tell. He's a great guy. Southern gentleman, they call him. He's been around the sport forever and has met a lot of great people, and he's just a really great person. We're going to have a great interview with Boyer Coe. You guys will really appreciate this. All right, I do want to mention we are brought to you by Redcon One. At Redcon One, everybody wants to be a champion. Everybody wants to be the best. And at Redcon One, they believe in working hard to achieve your goals. Whether you're killing it in the gym or running a six-minute mile, Redcon One has something for those willing to put in the work. Their premier clinically dosed pre-workout called Total War is the perfect companion to your workout to give you that extra push to break through your mental and physical barriers. You can fuel your body after the workout with the revolutionary MRE. It is the only whole food complete meal replacement with protein coming from salmon, chicken, beef, and eggs, and carbs coming from sweet potatoes and oats. And it also contains 10 grams of fat from MCT oil. This is the best-tasting complete meal you will ever have. So go to redcon1.com and try the very best that sports nutrition has to offer. Redcon One, the highest state of readiness. And as a sponsor of the show, you can enter the discount code LEGENDS and get a 15% discount off their order. And I also saw on their website today, they have a new transformation contest. It's called Transform with Redcon One for 2018. And Aaron Singerman, the owner of the company, is offering $10,000 prize to the winner of that contest. So you just have to purchase a stack, whether you're trying to build muscle, lose fat, or body recomposition, and you can enter the contest. And if you already have the stack of supplements, if you're already a Redcon One customer, you can just spend $59.99 to enter the contest if you already have the supplements, and you can be eligible to compete. So that's a $10,000 prize. I think it's going to last about 8 weeks. I think it ends at the end of March. So go to redcon1.com for details on that. The contest actually began on January 7th, and it will end on January 31st. So make sure you get there and get into that contest if you want to do that before the deadline. And we're also brought to you by Old School Labs. With so many supplements on the market, it can be hard to know which brand is the right one. As a three-time Natural Mr. Universe and Natural Mr. Olympia winner, the quality of supplements and knowing what I'm taking is very important to me, which is why Old School Labs is giving you 12% off your purchase. So just go to oldschoollabs.com and use the code LEGEND12 at your checkout. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. And Old School Labs is really expanding. They have brought on Samir Banute, 1983 Mr. Olympia. Talk about a classic physique. And he is now representing the company along with Breon Ansley, who is the current Classic Physique Olympia champion. And Breon is getting ready for the Arnold Classic, which is going to be holding Classic Physique this year in Columbus, Ohio. And that'll be the first weekend of March. So That's really exciting. And of course, they also have Sergio Oliva Jr. on the team. So they are really getting to be a bigger and bigger company. So go to oldschoollabs.com and check them out. All right. This week, in addition to my interview with Boyer Coe, I also had a chance to interview John Torelli. And John Torelli is a great bodybuilder from Australia. He was probably Australia's number one bodybuilder for many years. He competed in the IFBB, took second to Lee Haney in 1983 at the Caesars Grand Prix event that they had, which was held in conjunction with the movie Pumping Iron 2, The Women. John had a great symmetrical physique, and he competed really high on the IFBB. He took, I think, fifth place at the Pro World in 1986, and he competed in the Mr. Olympia that year. So we had a great interview with John about his whole career. And in addition to competing in the IFBB, John also competed in the NABBA Mr. Universe a couple of times. And he actually ended his career by winning the pro division of the Natural Universe. I think that was in 1993. That interview will be coming up for you on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast next week. So be sure to check that out. And I've been talking to some other guys about being on the show. And I've had contact with them, so hopefully those interviews will be coming up pretty soon. John Citroni is one of them, and John, of course, is a great old-school bodybuilder. Competed in the 1960s with Arnold Schwarzenegger. I think John won his class in the amateur division of the Mr. Universe in 1966, the year Arnold took second to Chet Norton. And I believe John was also in it in 1967 and 1968, so I'm sure he's got some great stories to tell. And I also made contact with Ian Lawrence, who won the amateur division at the NABBA Universe in 1975. Me and Wayne talked about him last week on the show. So he is interested in talking to us. And Lance Dreher, who was a big idol of mine when I was growing up in Chicago, because Lance was from the Chicago area, and he was an amazing bodybuilder. He was the first guy I ever saw with 20-inch arms or 22-inch arms. His arms were incredible. And Lance had a great physique. And we all really admired him on the Chicago area level. And we always felt that he would be the guy to win the Mr. America if anybody could. And he did it in 1981. He won the heavyweight class at the Mr. America when Tim Belknap won the overall. But then Lance went on to win the Mr. Universe contest with the IFBB, the IFBB World Championships, when it was held in Egypt. And Lance won the heavyweight class over Gunnar Rospo. So Lance is a great champion. And after that, he didn't have much luck with the IFBB, so he went over to the NABBA Mr. Universe, and he had some great success with them. So hopefully we can get a chance to talk to Lance. He is now in Arizona, and he has a radio show out there. So I'm hoping to talk to Lance Dreher. And then finally, I got a chance to talk to John Brown. And John Brown, of course, is a legendary bodybuilder who won the NABBA Universe, I believe, three times. And he's also famous for helping out the careers of Sean Ray and Vince Taylor and Melvin Anthony. And so John was a great poser, and he helped all these guys become great posers and also become great bodybuilders. So John is really a legendary bodybuilder in his own right for helping not only having a great career of his own, but for helping these other bodybuilders become great competitors. So John sounds like a great guy. Hopefully I get a chance to talk to him next week. So you should have some really good interviews coming up in this NABBA Mr. Universe series. And I hope to also talk to Peter McGuff again, because Peter was at several of the NABBA Mr. Universe shows because he lived in England. And we'll also do another wrap-up interview with Wayne Galash, where we'll talk about more of the winners of the NABBA Mr. Universe contest. So we've got some really, really great interviews coming up on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, and I also want to mention my books are really still doing well. So thank you to all the people who have bought the books. If you can go on Amazon.com, I have two books for sale there now. One is called The Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends, Volume 1, and it is all about the competitions from the 1970s. We got some great stories in there, some great pictures in there, so be sure to check that out, Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends, Volume 1. It's on Amazon.com, and I also have a workout book called The MP6 Workout, and that is about cycle training to build more mass and power. And of course, if all of you are familiar with bodybuilding, know that the best way to get bigger is to use the heaviest weights possible for that 6 to 10 rep range using the right exercises. And this book shows you how to do that, because we have cycles in there specifically designed to increase your power. And then after you build your power, you do the same workout with higher reps, but you'll be stronger for the mass. So you're using power first and then building mass And that's why we call it the MP6 workout. So that's doing really well. And I've been using that workout now, as I mentioned, for several years myself. And it's been giving me some great workouts. And I've made some great progress, believe it or not, in my older age of 54 years old. Hopefully it can help you out too. So be sure to check that out on Amazon.com. And if you buy the books on Amazon, if you could leave a review of those books, I would really appreciate it. And also for this podcast, if you were listening to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast on iTunes, if you could go to iTunes or just go to where it is on your phone and right underneath the logo, you should be able to leave a review. If you could do that, that would be great. All right. And I do want to mention a couple of the guys I've been helping with my training and nutrition programs out here in Tampa. I want to give them a shout out. First of all, Eric Marino. Eric is kind of a younger guy, but let himself get out of shape. He works right at the Powerhouse Gym in Tampa, Florida, where I train. And they have a Nutrition Factory restaurant. And they make meals there and they sell supplements. So Eric is one of the managers there. But Eric started off only 2 months ago at November 17th. He was weighing 212 pounds and his waist was 42 3/4 inches. So in only 2 months, Eric has gone down to 186 pounds and his waist has dropped to 37 inches. So he's lost about 6 inches off his waist, and that's only in 2 months. That's an incredible progress. I know when I'm dieting, my goal is to lose like an inch off my waist every month. So Eric has lost like 3 inches a month in the last 2 months. He's totally transformed his body. I just redid his diet and his training yesterday so he can start to put on a little bit more muscle and keep the muscle that he has and also keep losing that fat to really get that hard rip look. So Eric is going to look completely different in another couple of months. So congratulations to him. And also I have another client. His name is Larry Brazil. And Larry started off at 239 pounds, even heavier, and his waist was 43 3/4. And now, I've been working with him for 3 months, he is down to 199 pounds with only a 38-inch waist. So again, that's about 6 inches off his waist. And Larry is also doing the weight training and the cardio. So he's building muscle as he's losing fat. So these guys are really making unbelievable progress. I had to give them a mention. Congratulations to both of them. Larry's lost 40 pounds in only a couple months, and Eric has lost 26 pounds. But the goal is not just to lose the weight. The goal is to transform your body and go from that dad bod to rip bod. And I am now developing a website called dadbodtoripbod.com. I'll let you know when it's up. If you want to check that out, you want to get on the program and start changing your body, or if you know somebody that wants to change their body, male or female, any age, doesn't matter. It's just using the right protocol as far as training and nutrition. If you go onto that website, when it's up, you can start to enter the program. But if you want to do it now, just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right. I also want to mention we're brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing they're there for you every step of the way. They also have very competitive pricing along with their quality products and services. So those are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at 813-922-8939. And if you want to email them, you can email them at info@flalternativemeds.com. Again, the number is 813-922-8939. And the email is info@flalternativemeds.com. They have a brand new office out here in Tampa, Florida, but they will work with anyone from across the country in the United States. So be sure to give them a call or email them and talk to Jeff and mention that you heard the ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast and use the promotion code LEGEND and you'll get a free consultation. Plus, you'll get 20% off their packages that you buy. All right. So that is it for our opening. Here is our interview with Boyer Co. You're really going to enjoy this for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Here you go. All right. Welcome to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And my very special guest this week is Boyer Co. And Boyer Co. is one of the best bodybuilders in the 1970s and the 1980s, and is also one of my favorite interviews I've ever done here on the show. So, Boyer, welcome to the show again.
Thank you, John. Nice to be with you.
Well, Boyer, we're talking about the NABBA Mr. Universe. And I know when we did our interview a couple of years ago, can you believe that was 3 years ago already that we did that interview?
I knew it was a while back. I didn't realize it had already been 3 years. That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's funny, as you get older, time goes by a lot faster.
But I remember on that interview, you were talking about how you thought the NABBA Mr. Universe was one of your biggest honors of your career when you won that. And I think you won that 3 times.
Yes, without a doubt, you know, all the many years I competed, that was the thing that was the most meaningful to me. Not because it had a great hoopla and there was no money involved in anything, but it was such a great honor to participate in something that all the greats like John Grimmick and Steve Reeves and Reg Park and Bill Pearl had won. And just to be able to be part of that was a great honor to me, and especially to be successful, you know, and actually winning the contest to enjoy that select group. That was something that I'll never forget.
Yeah, we just did a sort of a wrap-up of the history of the NABBA Universe with Wayne Galash. I believe you know Wayne, right, from Australia?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And we were talking about all the winners starting from, well, I think it actually started in, the NABBA Universe actually started in 1950, but they had another Mr. Universe in 1948, and John Grimmick beat out Steve Reeves, and then Steve Reeves won the first one in 1950, and he beat out a young Reg Park. And then Bill Pearl came along in 1953. So the list of the winners was just amazing. When you look at the history of that sport.
There was another guy, too, that was and most people don't remember this guy, who was an outstanding bodybuilder, way ahead of his time. And that was a guy by the name of Jack Dillinger.
Yeah.
From Oakland, California. I mean, I was a great admirer of his physique. He also won the NABBA Universe.
We did talk about him, and Wayne was talking about how great of a physique he had.
He was far ahead of his time.
Well, Boyer, let's talk a little bit about how you got into bodybuilding. I know you were born in 1946, and you became interested in building muscles and building strength at a really young age, right?
Well, you know, it's funny. It was just something I think that was just inborn in me. I was always interested in trying to be big and strong. You know, I didn't really equate so much barbells, but I remember the first, I guess you would call it, bodybuilding magazine that I was aware of was a little pamphlet that was published by Irving Johnson, who was out of Chicago, who later became Rio Blair.
Sure
you remember that name. Mm-hmm. He had a little magazine called Tomorrow's Man, and it was about bodybuilding. I was only about 5 years old. I didn't go to school yet, so I couldn't read, but I would look at the pictures and admire that, and I'd say, wow, that's what I'd like to look like. And I was always active. I was always outside, like trying to chin myself and stuff like that. So I was always interested in physical development from a very, very young age. And I guess about the time I was maybe 11 years old, I never will forget this. A buddy and I were out in a drainage ditch trying to catch some turtles, of all things. And a car goes by this drainage ditch and throws out some magazines. Well, a couple of those magazines were Muscle Builder and Mr. America that were Weta publications.
Wow.
So immediately, I see those magazines. I forget all about the turtles. I sit down and I read both of those magazines cover to cover. And then immediately from that time on, I was at the newsstand weekly trying to buy a bodybuilding magazine.
Wow, I never heard that story before. That's great. When we were going over the Mr. Universe winners with Wayne, Red Lyrile was one of the guys that was a winner, and he was a mentor of yours, right?
Oh, most definitely. I owe so much to Red. You know, he's virtually been my mentor my entire life. I mean, he not only taught me so much about bodybuilding, but about business and life. I mean, we probably talk at least once or twice a week.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
really?
He's 81 years old. He still lives in Louisiana, but we're very, very close. But, you know, talking about the NABBA Universe, I mean, if I can back up a couple of years, I can kind of give you a little bit of history, maybe help people understand.
Okay.
It was a history, like if you won the AAU Mr. America, York Barbell would sponsor you or pay your trip to London for the NABBA Universe.
Mm-hmm.
So, as you know, in 1967, Dennis Tenorino won. He went over to the NABBA universe, but he was unsuccessful. Arnold beat him. That was the first time Arnold had won. Because the year before that, Chet Yorton had beat Arnold.
Right.
So, in 1968, Jim Haislip wins the Mr. America. York Barbell pays his way over, but he loses to Dennis. Dennis had come back and won the NABBA universe.
Mm-hmm.
So, in 1969, I'm fortunate enough to win the Mr. America. I'm all excited. I'm going to get to go to the Mr. Universe. So, the contest was always held in late September. So, by August, I hadn't heard anything from York or Bob Hoffman. So, I called up John Grimmick, and I said, you know, it's my understanding that it's a tradition. York pays the Mr. America's way to the Mr. Universe. He says, well... He says, yes. He says, that's true. But he said, unfortunately, the last couple of years, guys we've sent over haven't won. So we decided we ain't going to pay you way over. So I'm thinking, gee, boy, I was disappointed. I guess he could tell I was disappointed. He says, I'll tell you what. He says, if you go over and you win, then we'll pay you. Well, I was fortunate enough to go over and win, but he never paid for my trip. I had to foot the bill myself.
Wow, I never heard that story either.
Yeah.
What was the first contest you ever did, Blair? What year was that?
Oh, my God. You mean just the first bodybuilding contest?
Yeah, when you were a teenager.
Oh, God. I think it was a teenage Mr. South in Birmingham, Alabama. I couldn't have been more than about 15 years old. Had absolutely no experience. Had never even seen a bodybuilding contest. My only exposure to bodybuilding at that time was just through what I saw in the magazine. So you look at the pictures, you try and duplicate the poses, but I wanted to see what it was all about. So we went to Birmingham. I was 15 at the time and competed in a contest. It was a guy from New Orleans, Gable Boudreaux, won the contest.
Yeah,
funny thing about him, he was a good physique. He had great physique, but he wasn't a teenager. He was already 22 years old. But nobody checked. I mean, you just go up and tell them how old you were, and that was, he told him he was 19, and that's all they required, you know. But later on, I found he was 22 years old. No wonder he was good. He was better than everybody else.
Right. And then when you were 17, you won, what was that show you won? I think it was in Louisiana, and it wasn't a teenage show. It was an open-level show, but said there was a huge crowd.
That was the interesting thing. I see, that was the first contest when I was 15. Didn't know anything about it. Okay. I didn't even have a pair of posing trunks. I just used a pair of swim trunks. So, I mean, I looked ridiculous up there. So, I had competed when I was 17. A guy sends me an entry form for the Mr. Louisiana contest about a week before the contest. So, I said, okay, I got to try and do this. So, go to New Orleans. That's where the contest was held at. And I ended up, didn't really, again, have no experience. I ended up placing third, and I won a few body parts. So that was in January. So then May comes with the Mr. New Orleans contest. Now, that at that time, that was the biggest contest in the entire South. And it's also one of the oldest contests in this country. It was started even before the Mr. America.
Wow.
Because I had met a guy when I was a lot younger. He had won a Mr. New Orleans contest, and it was held in 1932.
Wow.
That was well before the Mr. America. So anyway, and that was also the first contest that I won was a Mr. New Orleans. But what was significant about that contest, at the time, it was held at Pontchartrain Beach, which was outdoors, which was a huge amusement park. Okay, so the evening that the opening of the Pontchartrain and amusement park was done, they had a huge amount of people there. That was the largest crowd I'd ever posed to. There was about 15 to 20,000 people there. I've never posed a crowd of people, universe, anything. Yeah, so that was quite an accomplishment. I did that, I think I won a contest, and it was right before I graduated from high school. It was about 3 or 4 days before I graduated from high school. So that was quite a satisfaction there.
How did the people in high school, your other students, how did they take to you being a bodybuilder? Because I know I started bodybuilding in the late 70s, and everybody thought it was the weirdest thing ever.
Oh, I was a complete oddity. They didn't know what to do with me. But the interesting thing about it in going through high school, and I went through high school with a bunch of really badass kids. Everybody thought I was badass because I was so much stronger than everybody else. It wasn't that I was tough or anything, but I got a certain amount of respect just because I was so much stronger than everybody else. So they automatically assumed, wow, if this guy is strong, he must be one bad son of a bitch. And I really wasn't, but nobody messed with me.
And you bench pressed 400 pounds when you were still in high school, right?
Oh, yeah, I did. That was my goal. That's one of the things I wanted to do. I don't know why bench press was so important, but that was one of the things I loved to do. So I made up my mind, I guess when I was about 14, I said, I got to do 400 pounds, basically because way back in those days, there wasn't a whole lot of people really that strong in, you know, or at least I didn't know about it. In the sport. So I figured, well, if I could do that 400 pounds by the time I got out of high school, that would be a good accomplishment. Much of my stuff was always done by me writing down and setting a goal or a time limit. I had to do this by such and such a time. And then I would sit it and then go about trying to accomplish that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I remember you said you would write that down all the time, 400.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, I got in a lot of trouble in high school from doing that because I carved 400 in my desk. I mean, it was just covered with 400. And I mean, they raised so much hell, they had to put another desk in the room. I got in a lot of trouble for that.
What was the contest you went in? I think it was in Texas where you went out the wrong door when you were getting ready for the show.
Oh, no. That happened in going back to that Mr. Louisiana contest that it was held in January. The interesting thing about that, see, once again, I didn't know why. I had no experience.
Yeah.
So I'm in the pump-up room, and I'm watching these other guys copying what they were doing to try to keep from looking like a fool. So we're in the pump-up room, and I'm pumping up, getting ready for the show. All of a sudden, I realize I'm the only one left in the pump-up room. Everybody else was getting ready to line up to go on stage. So I said, I missed out. So I must be late. So I run out the wrong door. It was held at the YMCA. The door slams shut. Okay, so now I'm standing in the alley and nothing but my pulling trunks and baby oil on, and it's cold as hell. It's in January.
Right.
And I'm beating on the door, but no one's in the pump-up room. I can't get back in. So I have to run all the way a block, all the way around the YMCA, and come in through the front door to where the crowd is at.
Right.
I mean, my heart was—I thought it was going to beat through my chest. Okay. So I get right through the front door as they're calling my name. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I make my way. I get up on the stage, you know, and I mean, of course, nobody looking at my feet, but my feet were all dirty from running. Right. Around the block. So
you had to run through the audience to get back up on the stage.
Well, yeah, but I had to run around a block down the alley and around the front door to get in barefoot,
right,
you know?
Right.
So my dad was with me. So after the contest was over, we're driving home the next day. You're just daydreaming, driving back. He says, you know, he said, that was pretty cool. He says, how you came in through the entrance. He said, that surprised a lot of people. I didn't have a heart to tell him that I'd gotten locked out. You know, that's why I had to do it. So he never knew that I was just such a fool that I had to run all the way around the alley to get in the front door to compete in the contest.
That's a classic story. You know, one of the things I noticed when I was going over your contest history was a lot of you guys, when you were competing in the AAU, you were in the same shows every year. And you sort of grew up with each other. Like you and Dennis Tenorino competed against each other many times as a teenager.
Oh, God. Dennis and I were the best of friends. We started competing. The first time I competed against Dennis was in 1965 in the Teenage Mr. America contest. That's how far back it goes. He was a wonderful friend, a great, great guy. And such, not only a good physique, but such a likable guy and such a big heart. He would help anybody out. In 69, when I went to the Mr. America, I'd never been outside of the United States before. So in those days, you know, the little town I lived in, Lafayette, Louisiana, was just a regional airport. So you'd have to fly from there to New Orleans, and then New Orleans to New York, and New York to London.
Okay.
So I met up with him when I got into New York, and then we went over together to, you know, to London, to the universe. And he kind of showed me around that first year. And he was a wonderful, wonderful guy. Well, and everybody got along. I mean, it was, you know, you competed, you wanted to win, you wanted to do your best. But if the other guy won, you congratulate him. There was no hard feelings. I mean, well, first of all, people don't realize the guy, the contestant, has not a damn thing to do with winning. It's the judges that decide who wins.
Right.
You know, so if the other guy beats you, you shouldn't feel bad for the other guy. The judges voted him the best.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times today, guys, they don't understand that. They hold a grudge if the other guy wins and they think they're better.
Yeah, I remember I interviewed Chris Dickerson, and he said that it was such a great time back then because there was such camaraderie. It was all the same group of guys that would compete. And like you said, you didn't take it seriously. You're like, okay, you beat me this time, I'll beat you next time. And after the show was over, you guys would all go out to eat. And sometimes you'd even stay together in a hotel if you couldn't all afford your own room.
That's the thing. I remember when Dennis won the Junior Mr. America contest. Well, none of us had any money. We'd pool our money together. We'd all stay in the same room. I remember when Dennis won, Dennis, me, Chris Dickerson, I think there was a fourth guy stayed in the same room. Some guy would sleep in the bed. Some guy would sleep on the floor, you know, but at least we had a room to stay in.
And you said back then, too, the AAU was running it, so they would have the weightlifting competitions first, and they would put the bodybuilding last, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, that was one of the things that I got interested in. Powerlifting was just to kill some time because you... You know, you get to a bodybuilding contest and you'd have to wait. The weightlifting was over, and sometimes it wasn't over with till midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning before the bodybuilding contest even got started.
So you went into Teenage Mr. America in 1965, and you got second to Dennis,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Dennis won. That's right. Dennis won. He was really good.
And then you won it the next year in 1966.
Correct, yeah.
And then you went into the Junior Mr. America in 66, and that was the one that Sergio was in, right? That's where you first met Sergio?
Oh, God, yeah. That to me was another outstanding moment. I had saw a couple of photographs of Sergio in Iron Man, and he looked unbelievable. But he was a guy that even, and I know you've seen him in person, he was a guy that your mind just couldn't comprehend when you saw him, that he was real. He just looked like a caricature. And I've read in the past where people say, you know, he was belligerent, he wasn't nice. But I always felt Sergio to be an extremely nice guy. You know, I got along with him really well. But he was unbelievable. And not only was he such a unique physique, but the way he dressed made him really stand out. You noticed that Sergio Oliva was in the room when you were around him. He was a great guy, you know. I'm sorry that in his later years, and I regret that I didn't have a chance to visit with him before he passed away, because I had a lot of respect for him. And I recall when he passed away, there was no one, or they didn't have enough funds to put for his headstone.
Wow.
So I said, and I can't remember who was a guy that was kind of like his manager or something. So I contacted the guy. I said, well, look, I would certainly like to pay for Sergio's headstone. I mean, he was such a great bodybuilder, one of the greatest, and a great influence on me. And I said, well, who do I send the money to? So he writes back. He said, well, you can't send it to, and I don't remember what her name is, his ex-wife, he says, because I can't guarantee you that that'll happen. So I kept trying to call around. And as a result, unfortunately, it never got done. So to this day, I don't know if he has a headstone on his grave or not.
Wow. Yeah, I know my friend from Chicago, Dennis, he went to the funeral, and he said there weren't too many people there. So that was kind of a shame for someone who was such a mythic figure in the bodybuilding world and such a great bodybuilder.
He was tremendous. I wish I would have been able to. But I didn't actually even find out about the funeral or the memorial till it was already over with.
Yeah.
And I think maybe if people would have known in advance, you know, more people would have been able to attend it.
Yeah. And didn't you say at that contest that you guys actually taped his waist and his thighs, and his thigh was bigger than his waist?
Oh, yeah. It's funny. At that time, as unbelievable as he was, he did not weigh that much. He only weighed about 198 pounds. He wasn't even over 200 pounds. At that time, he and I were probably pretty close to the same body weight. But I remember, once again, because we had to wait through all the weightlifting, we were back there goofing around in the gym. Actually, that's how he and I got to be friends. Because one of the things that I was always exceptionally good at, and I don't know why, was climbing a rope. Okay? So they had a big rope up at the top of the rafters in the gym. So we're goofing around, and he tried to climb the rope, and he couldn't get all the way to the top. So I tried it, and I could easily get it all the way to the top. So he was impressed. I was only, I think I might have been 18 or 19 at the time.
Uh-huh.
So he was impressed that this kid could do that, you know. But I remember that people couldn't get over how small his waist was.
Right.
But he measured his waist, and it was 27 inches, because I was standing there. 27 inches. So then he measured each one of his thighs. Each one of his thighs was 29. And of course, later on, he got much bigger than that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But he just was unbelievable.
I mean, all these years later, that was 50 years ago, and I just posted a picture of him, I think from 1981, on my Facebook page yesterday, and all these people were commenting, you know, he's the best ever, he's the best ever. It's just amazing that all these years have gone by, and all these guys are so big now. But you look at Sergio, and he really was something special. Like one of the most unique bodybuilders ever.
I tell you, John, there is a photograph taken that I did everything in the world to get a copy of. It was taken at the 1972 Mr. Olympia in Essen, Germany. And it took me a long time to find out who took the photograph, and it was taken by Albert Busek. Mm-hmm. And it was Sergio's one-of-a-kind, you know, victory pose.
Yeah.
That was single greatest bodybuilding photograph, in my opinion, that was ever taken.
I agree with you.
There's several versions of it, but that one picture at the 72 Olympia outshines everything anybody has ever done. I don't care how big and how good you are, that photograph is so dramatic, it just stands alone.
Yeah, I agree with you. Let's talk about 1967. You went into a contest called the Southern States, which is out here in Florida. And your friend Jim Haislop was in that contest, and he took first, and you got second. And you remember that contest?
Yeah. Well, I only went to that contest for one reason, and that's because I found out that Bill Pearl was giving a posing exhibition there.
Okay.
And Bill Pearl was, you know, I've always admired Bill Pearl. He's become an extremely close friend of mine over the years. So I wasn't in that great a shape, but I wanted to go to the contest because I wanted to see Bill Pearl. And you're right, Jim Haislop was an excellent bodybuilder. I mean, he beat me like a drum for a couple of years, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Every contest we go in, he was first, I was second. It didn't matter where we went, he was always first. In 1968, we go to the Mr. America contest, you know, and I think I'm in pretty good shape, okay? Sure enough, he's there, you know. And everything had happened bad to me. Getting there, I lose my luggage, okay? I didn't have my posing trunks. I didn't have nothing.
Okay? Wow.
So I had to go out and either buy a toothbrush and a razor just so I could at least brush my teeth, take a shower, and so on. So the next morning, I'm thinking, how in the hell am I going to compete? I don't even have, you know, in those days, you had to have a suit on and you went for an interview.
Yeah, right.
I had no suit, no posing trunks, so about 30 minutes before the contest start, Red was with me. I said, what the hell am I going to do? He said, well, maybe you can go borrow somebody's posing trunks. So I said, I guess that's what we'll have to do. So about that time, finally a cab shows up. They found our luggage. We got there just in time. So sure enough, go to the contest. It's held in York, Pennsylvania. It's about 105 degrees in that auditorium. I mean, it's like a steam bath. So we're there. We're good. And for some reason, I got the crowd on my side. They were really cheering for me. And I was fortunate. I won most of the body parts. I think I won everything except best abdominals. Never could get, I just didn't have the genetics for good abdominals. But I won everything else and the most muscular. And Ace of Steel wins. And I'm thinking, Jesus, what the hell's wrong with me, you know? But you see, once again, there was no hard feelings. After the contest was over, we all went out and ate together, you know?
Right.
So then we go next year. I'm fortunate enough to win in 69, okay? But what took place in 69 was far more important than the contest itself. Because what happened, the day before I had to leave to go, I'm working out with a guy in the gym, and he put some rosin on his hands, you know, to get a better grip. Well, he's spotting me. I'm on the bench press. Some of the stuff comes off his hands and falls into my eye. Okay, so it starts bothering my eye, and I don't really take care of it. I'm trying to get ready to go to contest. So by the time I get to New York, I'm telling Dennis, I said, you know, I said, my eye's really bothering me. I still don't do nothing about it.
Right.
So we catch an overnight flight. We leave New York and we land in London, I guess, about 6:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. By the time I get to the hotel, I can't see out of my eye anymore. Thinking, my God, it's swollen up.
Wow.
So I check into the hotel. I said, I got to do something. So I get a cab, and I told the cab driver, I said, look, can you take me to the nearest hospital? So we dropped me off, and luckily I found a doctor. He cleans my eye out, and, yeah, I can see again. It feels good. But he says, okay, you got to wear this patch over your eye for 24. I'm thinking, oh, man, I don't want to look like a pirate. But So he puts his patch on my eye, so then I got to go back to the hotel. By that time, all the other competitors are there. So here's a guy who's the current Mr. America, and they think, hell, he's only got one eye, you know? So I said, oh, man. So then I became friends with some of the guys from England, like Frank Richards was a great guy.
Yeah,
Frank, those guys were extremely friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So we go out this night, and the night before the contest, I said, well, look, let's go over to Wag Bennett's house. He's a party over there. Mm-hmm. So killing time, I go. So I keep running into things because I can't see good. I only got one eye. So I said, this is embarrassing. So I finally, I guess about midnight, took the eye patch off and threw it away, and then I could see all right, you know.
And it ended up working good because you won the contest. You won your class, and you won the overall in your first NAVA universe.
And the funny thing about that contest was after the contest was over with, okay, so what you do, you go from the old Royal Hotel, which was really run-down hotel, but, hell, you didn't care, you know. You go from the coach would pick you up, bring you to the contest, and then bring you back to the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all I had on was my warm-up suit and my posing trunk and my little workout bag. So I didn't think to take any money with me. So the contest is over with, and I won, and I'm thrilled to death that I won. This is a great accomplishment. And I finally beat Jim Haslam.
You know,
after him beating me for 2 years, you know?
Right, he won the tall class, and you won the medium class.
Yeah, so, and then Franco won the short class.
Right.
So, the guy told us, you know, after the contest is over, you go out of the stage door and the bus will be parked, you know, a block down.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm taking my time. I'm going out, and there's an old gentleman there. I guess it was kind of the manager. So I said, I noticed when I went outside, I had all the streets blocked off. So I said, well, what's going on? I said, well, what's happened here? The guy says, oh, it's just, everybody's waiting to see the new Mr. Universe winner. I said, you mean the people are waiting to see people? I said, yeah. I said, man, they all raised their hand, they would shake my hands. So I was overjoyed. I got so involved in that, the bus took off and left me, okay? And I didn't have any money, so I couldn't catch a cab.
Right.
So I had to walk all the way back from where the Prince Albert Hall, I think was, back to the hotel. And I've always had a pretty good sense of direction, so I kind of figured out where the hotel was at. But it wouldn't have mattered. I could have walked back barefoot. It didn't make any difference to me.
Right. You're so happy.
Because I was so happy. So then later that night, we all go out. We're going to celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
So Frank Richard and a bunch of his buddies from England were in this bar. So Frank and I get up to go to the bar to order drinks for, there must have been 7 or 8 guys. So we're standing at the bar talking, and right next to Frank and I, but on Frank's side of the bar, were 2 lesbians, okay? So all of a sudden, they get in this hellacious fight. They're fighting and throwing drinks everywhere, and they throw a drink all over Frank's suit, and he's pissed.
Okay?
So he immediately grabs one of them. Well, when he grabs one, okay, the second one turns on Frank, and she jumps on Frank's back, and she's clawing him all up. So I grab her and pull him off of him.
Right.
And as I spin around, I see the strangest thing I have ever seen in my life until this day. I don't know if you've ever seen people who have, and I'm trying to think of the correct name. They call it a werewolf syndrome. It's called hypotrichosis. In other words, it's people where they grow hair for whatever reason all over the body. Their face and everything is covered. Everything. Mm-hmm. It looks like a werewolf. Okay, when I spin around and pull this girl off of Frank's back, this guy is standing right in front of me. Scares the living shit out of me. I'm thinking, my God, what the hell is going on? I thought it was a werewolf, you know?
It was Lon Chaney.
Well, what? This guy was the bouncer in the place.
Really?
He grabbed those 2 lesbians. He just smashes their heads together and drags them out of the place. So now he wasn't able to talk. He couldn't talk.
Really? Wow.
He comes back in, and he made Frank and I understand. He wanted to thank us for breaking the thing up because they were just breaking glass. I told Frank, I said, you know, I think it's time for us to get the hell out of here. But that, and you know, it's funny, after I saw that, I thought about it for a long time. There's only 50 or so people in the world that have that rare condition.
Really? Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's very, very unusual. And this happened to be one of them.
He was right there.
Oh, wow. God. I'm telling you, that was, like I said, the events leading up to and after the contest were much more eventful than the contest itself.
Yeah, that's why it seemed like such a great time back then, because everybody would hang out and you guys all were friends, and it just seemed like such a great great atmosphere to be around, you know?
Well, the thing is, to be honest with you, John, I really don't follow bodybuilding that closely anymore because it's changed so much. It seems like nowadays, I mean, once again, it's just my opinion. I haven't been to a contest in years. It just seems like it's all about how much money the promoter can make off of the show.
Yeah.
I mean, you got so many different divisions.
Yeah.
That, I still train every day, and I was in the gym, I guess it was this past Sunday, and I'm overhearing this girl talk that was next to us, and she was telling this guy how expensive it is. I guess she was competing in the bikini and how much her suit costs her and her diet and a spray tan and all that stuff. And she says, you know, she says, it cost me like $3,000 to enter the contest. And I'm thinking, Jesus, you know. And this was a young girl. She probably maybe just out of high school, maybe 19 or 20 years old.
Yeah.
So I said, well, how did you do? She says, oh, I placed 7th. And she says, I'm real happy about that. And I'm thinking to myself, if you didn't win, you didn't do a damn thing. If you didn't come out first, to me, it doesn't matter. First place, much less 2nd or 7th or whatever it is, you know. But yeah, I didn't see anything. But But it's a totally different concept to when I was competing.
Yeah, it is. It's, well, you know, you think about when you were competing, the years we're talking about, there was just bodybuilding. The women weren't involved with it at all. So
yeah, right. And I can remember when the very first, what they call a very, I guess it was the first women's bodybuilding show, or mm-hmm. one of the first, Frank Zane put it on out here. And I think, God, Stacy Bentley won the contest.
Yeah, I remember her.
She was in the contest, and also Rachel McClish was in the contest.
Wow.
And I remember going to it. It was held at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. And I'm thinking, I don't think this is ever going to fly, you know?
You're right.
But obviously it did. And then now apparently women's bodybuilding has entered. But if you got women's physique, it's almost the same thing anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The bodybuilding is pretty much died off, but now they have other divisions, especially the bikini. Like you said, that's the big one. That's the one all the girls are going in.
That's the thing. Everybody likes to look at pretty women in tiny bikinis.
Yeah.
I mean, hell, if there was nothing else, guys would show up for that, you know?
Right. And I think the women like it too, because they like dressing up. They like the makeup looking glamorous, you know, the high heels and everything.
That's true. But, you know, getting back to the Nava universe, one of the guys that certainly didn't get enough credit and deserves a lot of credit was Oscar Heidenstam, the guy who actually ran the Nava Universe. I mean, that was one of the things that stuck in my memory when I went over there the first time. The guy was so gracious. He was so nice to everybody, you know, and I actually became friends with him over the years. And I even tried to, at one time, of course, I wasn't successful in doing it, putting him together with Ben Weider.
Oh, really?
But Ben was willing to work with him, but Oscar apparently didn't trust Ben Weider, so that was never able to put anything together. Because I kept telling Ben, I said, Oscar's such an honorable guy, he would be an asset to your organization.
Yeah.
But Oscar was always too suspicious of the Weiders, and naturally, you know, they didn't have the best reputation.
Mm-hmm.
But Oscar was a wonderful man. He deserves a lot of credit. And another thing, too, that, like you had brought up, more to me than anything in all of the stuff that I did in bodybuilding was all the great friendships I made, you know, with all the guys I competed against, you know. I mean, one guy in particular that I had stayed friends with for many, many years was a guy by the name of Eli Pessis. He was from South Africa. Great, great physique, and I mean a wonderful guy. And he was from Greece. And I asked him, I said, how in the hell did you end up from Greece into South Africa? He said, well, my brother and I decided we wanted to go anywhere just to go traveling. So he said the first place we could get a visa to was South Africa. So that's where they went. And they settled there, and they became very successful in the bakery business.
Oh,
and
okay.
So that's I honestly, I don't know if he's still there or not. I haven't talked to him in quite a few years, but he, and then there was another guy that I've stayed friends with till this day, a guy by the name of Warren Langman. He was, he owned a gym in Pietermaritzburg, South Africa, and he would bring all of the American bodybuilders over. He was a promoter. Like he brought Arnold over, he brought Frank Zane, Dave Draper, He is a successful guy. He's retired now, but he actually lives in Tasmania. But I got an email from him just a couple of days ago.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I remember that name.
Yeah. Oh, a great, great guy, you know.
Yeah, me and Wayne were just talking about Elias Petsis when we were going over the winners of the Universe. He had a great physique.
The last I heard from him, I think he had finally, you know, because South Africa's changed so much, I think he'd finally moved back to Greece, but I lost track of him, you know. Another thing, too, you have to remember about the Nava Universe was the great tradition. Not only you had those guys that I always admired won a contest, but that trophy they gave, that was a real collector's item. It wasn't a big, monstrous trophy, but it was sterling silver, and it was that great pose of John Grimmick on it. And it probably wasn't more than maybe, I don't know, a foot and a half tall if it was that tall. But it was quality.
Yeah.
And then long about 73, the people in Europe would see these 6-foot trophies that Weider was giving away. So they started complaining to Oscar, said, we want those kind of trophies. And to me, they lost a lot when they went to just the wooden plastic trophies like everybody else.
Yeah.
So I'm talking to Oscar, and I said, you know, Oscar, I said, I have an idea for a trophy. I said, when Steve Reeves won in 1950, that was before you had the traditional NABBA Universe trophy. What it was a copy of the Sandow statue that Reeves won. It was the bronze statue. It was the third place statue. So he said, I said, why don't you go back to that? I said, that would be a unique trophy. So I was trying to help him locate it. And I tracked down this guy, Dave Webster, who is from England. And he says, I know the family of the individual that actually won the contest when Sandow actually presented him the trophy, the gold trophy. And the guy was from England. I mean, excuse me, from Scotland.
Yeah.
So in 1975, when I went over again for the NABBA Universe, he persuaded those people to let him bring the trophy to the NABBA Universe. So there's a picture of me holding that trophy. As a matter of fact, if you have Randy Roach's book, Muscle Smoke and Mirrors, Volume 2, there's a picture of me holding that trophy in that book.
Right, I remember
and
that.
So I'm thinking, this would be a great idea. So then in 1976, Arnold called me and he says, you know, I'm putting on the Olympia in Columbus. He says, will you compete in it? I said, okay, I'll do it. So I went there to compete in the contest. And what's interesting that happened, Ben, when we get there to contest, Ben said, well, you can't compete in the Mr. Olympia. And I said, well, why not? He said, well, you're not a member of the IFBB. I said, well, I was invited by Arnold to compete. And I have to give Arnold credit. He went to bat for me and, you know, he forced Ben to let me in the contest. And, you know, Franco won. So after that, Ben and I got along very well. So right after that, that's when he held the IFBB Mr. Universe in Montreal that year. So he invited me, I think me and Lou Ferrigno, to guest pose.
Yeah.
So at the contest, after it was over with, we're sitting on the bus waiting to take us back to the hotel. It was me, Arnold, Bill Drake, and Jim Lorimer, Arnold's partner. Mm-hmm. And Arnold's telling me, he says, you know, he says, I really want to try and create something special as an award for the Mr. Olympia, rather than in the past, I think they just gave like Larry Scott and Sergio just like a silver tray.
Yeah.
I don't really remember what they gave Franco, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I don't either.
So I said, so then I explained to him about Oscar Heidenstam and the Sandow statue. He said, hell, that's a great idea. So then we tried to find somebody who had the Sandow statue so we could make a copy of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Joe Weider had a copy at one time, and somehow or another they were able to get a casting of that. And then when Frank Zane won, they actually had the Sandow trophy, and it's been that way ever since for the Olympia Award. But that's where the idea of the Olympia Award came from, that Sandow trophy. That's a great story because, boy, that goes all the way back to, you might as well say, the beginning of bodybuilding.
Yeah, that is a great story because I remember when me and Wayne were going over the winners of the NABBA Universe, and when Steve Reeves first won it, I think, like you said, they had that trophy.
Yeah.
1950, right? And I do remember reading that in Randy's book, so I'm glad you brought that up again and told the whole story.
That I think eventually, okay, after Reeves passed, I'm trying to think who ended up purchasing that. But then also Reeves managed to actually, see, I had tried to buy at the time that gold statue, the gold-plated statue from the family in Scotland. And at that time, they wouldn't sell it. Mm-hmm. But years later, Steve Reeves managed to buy the statue. And then he had, at some event, he had Serge Nubre present it to him. But that's how, and as far as I know, the guy who oversees Steve Reeves' estate still has that statue.
Okay. One thing I wanted to mention, not getting off track a little bit, but when we were talking about Jim Hayslop and that Southern States contest, the reason I brought that up was I was talking to a promoter out here, John Schleicher, who was a, I don't know if you remember John. He was a friend of Jim Hayslop and Frank Zane.
I definitely remember him. Yes, I do. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was from Tampa.
He was from Tampa, right. He still holds a contest out here at the Tampa Bay Classic. So he told me the story when you were in town to compete in the Southern States. Him and Jim were driving around. They were looking for you. And they saw you on the beach, and they recognized you by the vein that went across the front of your calf. Because Jim said, oh, yeah, there's that vein. That's him.
Yeah, I remember that. And the funny thing about that story, that is so odd. There's so many old characters there that, well, it was, I guess, a lot of characters that they, it seems like back in the day, the two most famous photographers at that time was Doug White, okay, and a guy on the West Coast by the name of Cliff Swan, who was a great friend of mine. Cliff took some of the best pictures ever taken of me at Leo Stern's gym down in San Diego. But anyway, Doug White was the one that was taking the photographs of me out there on the beach in Tampa. And I remember seeing, I don't remember seeing Jim, but I remember seeing the other guy. He was hiding behind a palm tree watching me. And I knew that's who he was.
That's funny. I'll have to tell him that. And you said you went to that contest, Boyer, just because Bill Pearl was
oh,
guest posing.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to see Bill Pearl pose, man. It was so funny because the day I went there, I had no idea. I knew I had to get to Tampa. But the contest wasn't held in Tampa. It was held in Winter Haven. Now, I don't know how in the hell I thought I was going to get to Winter Haven. But I got to Tampa, and I'm sitting there at the airport thinking, okay, now how am I going to get to Winter Haven? And I run into Doug White. So Doug says, well, look, he says, we'll catch you. He knew somebody there in Tampa. So anyway, later that day, we go over to, and I'm sure you remember the guy, Harry Smith had a gym in Tampa, okay? Great, great guy. So right across the street from Harry Smith's gym was a big apartment house. And that's where Frank Zane was living, and also was, you remember Dr. Craig Whitehead?
Yeah.
Okay, he was there. So Craig Whitehead, Frank Zane, Bill Pearl was there. We're all laying out by the pool. So I actually got to meet Bill Pearl first in person before he ever watched him pose. And then the next day was a contest, and I rode down to Winter Haven with Frank Zane. That was even before Frank married Christine. We rode down with him, and he gave us a ride back to Tampa after it was over with.
So what were your impressions of Bill? I know you're good friends of him, and you have a lot of great things to say about Bill Pearl.
Well, he was the only guy that I ever really aspired to be like. I wanted to be like him, not only because of his physique, but because of his personality, his demeanor in treating, he was always respectful to other people, and I admired that. He was a humble guy, and also he would tell you exactly what he thought, and I admired that about him. And that's why we've always managed to stay great friends. As a matter of fact, I talked to him, I guess it was in early part of November. I was out of town. I didn't get a chance to call him on his birthday. And I called him maybe 2 weeks later and spoke to him, and he's in good spirits. He's 87 years old, and as a matter of fact, I probably need to call him because he mentioned that he was going to have some kind of back surgery. So he may have gone through that by now. I need to call him and see how he's doing. But great, great guy, you know.
How was he doing, Blair, when you talked to him?
Well, he sounded like he was doing extremely well. Now, I know other people told me that he now has Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, I heard that too.
But he's able to, I guess he's got medication, and he's able to control it. Now, he doesn't make personal appearances anymore. He finally retired from doing that. But his attitude and his mind is just as sharp as ever. I couldn't tell any difference at all.
Yeah, what a great guy Bill was. I met him several times, and you know, he always remembers everybody, and he's always respectful to everybody, and it's just such a difference than most bodybuilders are. So he really stands out.
That's the thing that I like about it. There's no ego involved with him. That was one of the things that I really respected that about him.
Yeah.
It's funny. You're going back, we mentioned earlier, you know, when I won the Mr. New Orleans contest.
Mm-hmm.
I was telling, because Doug White was there. He was at the contest. But the next day, he took some photographs of me down at Pontchartrain Beach, and I was telling how much I admired Bill Pearl.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew Pearl. So Pearl must have wrote Pearl and told him that how much I admired him. So Pearl sent me one of his booklets.
Wow.
And I was super impressed. So I wrote Pearl. I mean, I'm a 17-year-old kid. Nobody's going to pay attention to me. So yeah. I wrote back a letter and thanked him. And he wrote me back. And he, hell, that was the start of the friendship. We wanted ever since then.
Yeah.
Also, too, he was close friends with Red. Red was in the Navy.
Oh, okay.
Stationed in Hawaii. And Pearl came over to Hawaii, give an exhibition. And then when Red got out of the Navy, he got transferred to the West Coast for a couple of months or so. So that's when Bill had a gym in Sacramento. So Red would drive up or catch a ride with somebody up to Sacramento and spend the weekend at Pearl's gym. And that's how they became close friends.
What did you think of Bill when you saw him pose at that Southern States, when you first saw him on stage?
Oh, he was, well, first of all, at that time, you never saw anybody that big and that proportioned. He, I'm just guessing, this is a long time ago, but he had to weigh, is not anything compared to the guys today, but he must have weighed 240 pounds. And, wow. And he was in shape. And he really knew how to pose. You could tell that the mm-hmm. guy had worked on his presentation.
Yeah.
I tell you something else that most people don't realize. Okay, Pearl has an older brother, Harold. Mm-hmm. Harold's 90 years old. He's still alive.
Is he really? Wow.
Harold was even bigger than Bill. I only had an opportunity to meet Harold once, see him in person. Uh-huh. And I was blown away how big this guy was. If he would have trained seriously, I think he would have been better than Bill. I mean, wow. To give you an idea how big he was, he could take his ring off his finger and pass a quarter through it. That's how big his fingers were. Another nice guy. But, I mean, those guys just had enormous bone structure.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And that was the year that Bill won the universe again, the year that Arnold won.
He did, right, yeah. Right. And then there was a lot of controversy, you know, in 71.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't have been, okay? But that mm-hmm. was basically started by Arthur Jones.
Mm, okay.
That had nothing to do with Sergio Oliva at all.
Yeah.
What happened was, you have to remember now, this is going back to 1960 and then 1970. We were both heavily involved with Arthur Jones and Nautilus. What happened was, Arthur was starting to produce the first couple of machines. The pullover machine was the very first one. I helped him prototype that on the front porch of his house, okay? The mm-hmm. next one he had was a plate-loaded bicep and tricep machine. So he sent a pullover machine and a bicep-tricep machine to Red's, and he sent a pullover and a bicep-tricep machine to Bill Pearl's gym. That's when he had his gym in Pasadena.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was plate loaded, okay? So what happened, somebody was using either the bicep or the tricep machine, and the bar slipped out of the hand, and another guy just happened to have his foot next to where the weights came down. Well, the weights came down and crashed, broke the guy's foot.
Mm.
So Pearl said, hell, he says, we can't have this liability in the gym. So he got Bob Clark to put a selectorized weight stack on it. Mm-hmm. Which greatly improved the machine. So when he told Arthur about it, Arthur got all pissed off at it and accused us of trying to start, because Bob was making pretty good equipment down in San Diego. Mm-hmm. Somehow Arthur got it in his head that we were conspiring against him. We were going to produce our own line of equipment, which never entered in anybody's mind. We had no intention to do that. Pearl just made an improvement on the machine. So that's when Arthur, to get back at Bill, that's when he recruited Sergio to compete against Bill.
Oh, okay. Now,
everybody talks about, oh, Sergio was big. Sergio did get bigger, but he didn't have the quality that Bill Pearl and the finesse that Bill had at that Nava Universe. So he was the rightful winner. Now, Bill, as great as he was, never had that freaky proportions that Sergio had. I'll give Sergio that. But then also Sergio wasn't, he just looked too big. You know, he wasn't pleasing to look at. And then Bill really knew how to present himself, presentation. Sergio, for all his muscle, really never spent a whole lot of time on his presentation.
Yeah, that was the thing about Bill. He was so prepared for these shows. You reminded me a little bit of maybe like Frank Zane.
He had everything ready. Right. Till the nth degree, you're right.
Talk a little bit about that prejudging at the NABBA Universe, because I know that was pretty unique, right? They just did it in a room. They didn't do it on a stage. And the judges were right there. And it was sort of flat lighting.
Well, yeah. In other words, you were just under natural lighting. I mean, it was in the hall. The prejudging was held in was just like it was a banquet hall in the Royal Hotel, which was not that big of a room. It only could hold maybe 300 or 400 people at the most. It wasn't a big room. It was just under natural lighting, and I mean. And it's also everything was on ground level. There was no stage, okay?
Yeah.
It might have had a little bit of a platform, you know, that was raised up maybe a foot, but at best that was it. And then you got to remember now, the judges were probably not more, maybe 15 feet away from you.
Right.
And then on top of that, you had the audience crowding around. I mean, I can remember people. You almost had to kick people out of the way to even get to where you were going to pose at. I mean, it was on top of one another, but it was exciting. The excitement was like electricity in the air. I mean, that's what I remember. I've been to the Mr. Olympia and the big production, but nothing came close to comparing the excitement that NABBA Universe had.
Wow. So what did it feel like, Blair, to win that universe, especially on your first try? I know, Jim tried it a couple times. Jim Haslop tried a couple times to win, and you came in on your first time. Was there any pressure on you to win it, or did you just go in and just to see how the best you can do?
I didn't have enough sense to have any pressure on me. You got to remember now, I went through all this deal with my eye. I thought I was going to have to compete with a eye patch on. So, I mean, I went to the contest, okay? You know, and I always try to do my best to, you know, put a positive spin on. I do remember we got in the day before, Dennis and I. That morning, I didn't know that Jim was going to be there because he had never shown up that night. But he flew in on the flight that arrived the morning, the day of the contest. So I saw him right at the prejudging when it was starting. And jokingly, because he had beaten me so many times, I said, you know, Jim, I remember telling him, I said, Jim, today is going to be different. I'm going to beat you.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, you know,
yeah. Right.
and so we all went out. We had a great time that night. And then the next day or 2 days later, he and I flew back to New York together.
Mm-hmm.
We shook hands. He flew on to Tampa and I flew on back to Louisiana, and he retired. He never competed. Now, Jim never reached his full potential. I mean, he was a great looking guy. He was broad-shouldered, blonde hair. He was like an epitome of an all-American guy. I wish he wouldn't have retired. He could have done so much more, but I guess he didn't. Maybe he didn't want it anymore. Maybe he'd had enough.
Yeah.
Do you ever see him in Tampa?
Yeah, actually, I got to meet him. I went over to his place and met him, and he showed me his Mr. America trophy, and he's got a little gym in his garage, and real humble, nice guy. And I'm supposed to interview him for this podcast, so I hope he takes me up on that. Tried calling him a couple times, but just a real humble guy and, you know, real nice guy.
Oh, terrific guy. I mean, I have nothing but respect for him. It's funny, when the last time I saw it was so odd. We shook hands there when we flew back from the 69 Miss Universe.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw him again until they held that. I'm trying to think when it was. It was, I can't remember the year. It must have been around 90 or 91 when they held the Mr. Olympia down in Orlando.
91.
Okay, I'm walking through the crowd. Okay, because you know, I had Body Masters equipment at that time. We had a display, so I'm trying to get to the crowd. And this guy comes up and says, "Hey, Boyer, how you doing?" I said, "Hey, good to see you." And I thought he looked familiar, but I couldn't remember him.
Yeah.
So I'm walking, I'm thinking, who is that guy? Who's that guy? Finally, it dawned on me, it was Jim. So I had to turn around and come back through the crowd and look for him till I found him. And then we had a nice little visit. Two people that I hadn't seen in years at the time was him. And I don't know if you remember this guy, Warren Frederick.
Mm-hmm. He's competing in Lord shows.
Warren Frederick was one of the most muscular guys
and
one of the nicest guys I ever met. I mean, this guy, everybody, if you touch him, they're hard. They're good. This guy, when you touched him, it was like punching concrete. Man, this guy was unbelievably muscular. Now, I think he's passed away since then.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Yeah, but I stayed friends with many, many years. But I hadn't seen him in years. But he apparently was living somewhere down around Tampa, too, on to see the Olympia. And what made me recognize him, I'm walking through this crowd of people, and for some reason, I'm really good at recognizing people's voices.
Uh-huh.
And I heard him talking, and I turned and looked, and I said, "Damn, that's Warren Frederick." And then he turned and looked at me, so we hugged, and I thought he had passed away. but he was a great guy, a lot of fun to be with, because, when I used to compete in Lurie's contest, he was always up there. He'd compete every year, he and also Bill Grant.
Yeah, that's who I remember, Warren, from all those contests with Dan Lurie.
Oh, yeah. Well, even he and they even went to the NABBA Universe one year. He, Bill Grant, and Lou Ferrigno all went to the NABBA Universe one year.
I can't remember
what year it was. Maybe it's like 72, 73, somewhere along
73, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about 1970. You go back to the NABBA Universe, and you compete in the pro this time because you won the amateur in 69.
Right.
And you win first in your short class, and Frank Zane won the overall that year in the amateur.
No, not in 1970. I won the short class. Arnold won the tall class. But what had happened that particular year, for some reason, I caught the flu on the flight over.
Mm.
And I threw up on the plane all the way over there. So I was dehydrated. So I wasn't feeling my best. But, I mean, Arnold was too good. He would have won anyway. I'm not saying that anything different. He dominated the contest. But you got to remember now, that was a great turning point in Arnold's career. That was a turning point. Because what happened, we competed one night, Saturday night, in the NABBA Universe. Okay. The very next night, we flew all the way back to Columbus, Ohio, and competed in that Mr. World contest that Jim Rohn put on.
Yeah.
I mean, that was unique in itself because our flight was delayed. We finally got out of London, flew to New York. Okay, I to this day, I don't remember us ever clearing immigration, customs, or nothing. As soon as we got off the plane, because Lorimer had obviously the right connections, we were escorted to a private jet, and I guarantee you within 30 minutes, we were on our way to Columbus, Ohio in a Lear jet. There was me, Arnold, Franco, and Dave Draper.
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy. So you guys left that night then, right after the universe.
We didn't leave until Sunday morning.
Oh, Sunday morning. Okay.
Sunday morning, and I'm trying to tell you, we flew back and at the weightlifting, everything was over with. And it kept delaying the start of the contest because we had never even arrived yet.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
And so when we finally got to the hotel, the guy says, "Okay, y'all, you got about 30 minutes. Y'all got to be ready." So we just get there, we pack, change in it, and we're off to the auditorium there to compete in the contest. And I think that was something that totally mystified Sergio because he was expecting Arnold to be there, you know. And then from that point on, you know, Arnold basically dominated the sport.
Yeah. Did you think Arnold deserved to beat Sergio at that show, at the Mr. World?
From what I remember, yeah, probably so. But you see, then just a couple of weeks later, they held the Mr. Olympia, and right. Sergio was prepared. And I think Sergio probably deserved to beat Arnold, but Arnold already had the momentum, and that's how he ended up winning. And you also got to remember, for whatever reason, and I don't know how that worked out, but I guess it's due to Jim Larmer's credit. That was the only contest that I remember that you had AAU people and IFB people all bunched together in one contest. Nobody complained about it.
Right.
No. Usually they would raise a big stink, but the Weeders didn't do it, and neither did, you see, Hoffman was still pretty powerful back in those days with the AAU. That was also the time, what was the guy's name? Alexei, the first guy that clean and jerked 500 pounds?
Vasily Alexeyev, yeah.
Yeah. The interesting story about him, I didn't see this happen, but I was told by a guy who did see it, he couldn't speak a word of English. Mm-hmm. And at that time, everybody stayed at that hotel right across the street from the state capitol in Columbus. Mm-hmm. So they said, at a certain period of time, you be standing outside of the hotel. We will have an interpreter meet you and, drive you over to the contest to compete. So he understands that. So sure enough, he's standing outside of the hotel waiting. This lady comes along, and they told her that the interpreter would be a female. Lady comes along, and she's waving to a friend of hers on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He thinks the lady is waving at him. Mm-hmm. So he runs over, hops in her car. Okay, here you got a guy that's got to be around 6'5", 400 pounds, hops in her car. She takes one look at this guy, runs screaming down the street.
Oh, that's hilarious.
This guy doesn't know what the hell he's supposed to do. Here he is. He can't speak a word of English, and he just got in a car, and there he jumps and runs away. But he finally got it straight, and, of course, he goes on to make history. But that must have been a sight. But a guy told me he had witnessed that.
That's hilarious. Well, that was a hell of a night because Vasily Alexeyev breaks the 500-pound record in the press. The Olympic record. And then Arnold beats Sergio for the first time and was on ABC Wide World of Sports.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was an amazing time.
So in you go back to the NAVAL Universe in 72, and that was the one I was thinking of. That's where you won. You won in the pro division that year, and you won or you got second to Frank in the short class.
Correct. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
How did Frank look that year?
Well, Frank looks like he always did. Frank is, I don't know how you can say it. He was never, he never had an exciting physique, okay? But he always looked good, okay?
Yeah.
He looked polished, he looked finished, he looked classy. The best way I can describe it is give you a couple of examples.
Okay.
Frank looked good. He probably looked better than anybody just standing relaxed. Because it was just pleasing to look at. But now, again, just like Chris Dickerson, it was pleasing to look at. But when they posed, not a whole lot happened. It didn't change a lot. Okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, now look, take another example. You take Casey Viator, okay?
Yeah.
Casey Viator standing relaxed, just like me, you probably wouldn't even notice him. But when he started posing, it was a shock. The body, it exploded. And that's what caught people's attention. And I think Frank was very successful because he looked so good from all angles, standing relaxed. But when standing next to him, he was never that big of a guy.
Yeah.
But once again, he was a guy that was always prepared, always had the best tan. But God, I mean, he used to lay out in the sun in Palm Springs for 7-8 at a time. He's very fortunate that his skin has held up as good as it has.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to Wayne about that when we were talking about it, because you would see some of these guys show up really white and other guys would be tan. But back then, the only way you could get tan was to actually get a real tan, right?
You had to lay in the sun.
Yeah, they didn't have all these tanning products.
Going, Well, let me go back to one thing, 1969, and I hadn't brought this up. You know, I knew that Jim Hazel was going to compete, and I'd competed against him a number of times, so that was no surprise. But when I got to the contest, you know, naturally you're standing back there in a pump-up room, prejudged, and you, everybody's checking everybody else out to see who your competition is going to be. The one guy that I was concerned about was a guy by the name of Walter O'Malley. I don't know if you were familiar with him.
I remember the name,
He was a big guy. Frank Richards was good. He was right there, too. He had a good physique.
Frank.
But Walter O'Malley, the best way I could describe him, he looked like, how can I say, it looked like a caricature that Frank Frazetta, I don't know if you're familiar with this illustrator, Frank Frazetta. Frank Frazetta was unbelievable. He was the best. But he drew all the covers for like Tarzan and the Conan books.
Okay.
Walter O'Malley looked like a caricature that Frank Frazetta had drawn for Tarzan. That's what it reminded me of. Hmm. The biggest, ruggedest looking guy there. Now he was just like he was so white he looked like porcelain. You know, but he was from Manchester. But I mean, I said, shit, this guy is going to be hard to beat.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, he wasn't professional in his presentation, but just a big, raw-boned, rugged-looking guy. And I remember Frank Richards telling me, he says, he likes to fight. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, we went out, and I don't know if this is an exaggeration or not. He says, he got in a fight somewhere. He knocked out 9 police officers one night.
Wow.
Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's a pretty damn good story.
So, Boyer, let's go back to the 73 universe then, and that was the one you won. You go back to the pro, and you win the pro over Dennis Tenorino, who won the tall class. And Tony Emmett was in your class,
Right, correct,
And Reg Park was in it that year, too.
Was it in 73 or 75?
This is 73 I'm looking at.
73, okay. I remember one year, and maybe it was 73 also, I think Chet Yarton came back.
That was 75, yeah.
Oh, 75, okay. Because
right.
I remember he made a big stink about we're all a bunch of steroid freaks. I mean, he was really, he was kind of a belligerent guy. I never really, I wouldn't say I didn't get along with him because I never knew him well, but he was just a different sort of guy.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, 73 was, you're right, it was Dennis. I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, and you won the Pro Mr. World that year, too, in the WVVG.
Oh, yeah. Well, the reason I would do that, I'd compete in that every year, okay?
Uh-huh.
But instead of taking the prize money, I would tell Dan, I said, okay, I don't want any prize money. Just pay for my plane ticket over to London.
Okay.
That's how it would work out.
Yeah, it looks like you won that contest, the Pro Mr. World, from 71 through 75. Every year you won it.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. It was a lot of fun, but that show that Dan Lurie put on always sort of reminded me of a carnival. It wasn't really a well-organized show. You could kind of get up there and do whatever you wanted. I remember Bob Goldman, what was he famous for doing handstand push-ups?
Yeah.
I mean, basically, if you wanted to do whatever you were good at, he would just let you up on stage to do it, you know?
Right. And sometimes he would hold his shows on the same day as the Olympia, right? If it was in New York, just to compete with Joe.
And you know what? I think he did a couple of times,
And then you went in the NABBA Universe in 74, but Chris beat you, Chris Dickerson. You guys had a long, long history of competing against each other and trading victories back and forth.
Yeah. Well, Chris was very, very successful, not only in that, but he was also very successful in IFBB, a lot of those Grand Prix. He did a lot of that. He was a real success. He always managed to show up in really good condition for those shows. And he was a good poser, too.
Yeah, it was amazing how he held his condition for so long.
Oh,
yeah. So many of those shows. Because they would be months apart.
Doesn't he live down somewhere around Boca Raton or somewhere?
Yeah, he's in Southern
down Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how he's doing now. I haven't talked to him in a while. But I think Bill Nealon.
Yeah, Bill's good friend.
He's close friends with Chris.
Yeah.
I talked to him yesterday.
Yeah, Bill's a great guy. He had a lot of good things to say about you.
Oh, yeah. He's a great guy. Funny guy, too.
So then you won your last NAVA Universe in 75. That was the last one you won. So that was three victories then for the NAVA Universe, correct?
I was planning on going back again in 76, but that summer, that's when Arnold called and told me, he asked me, would you, he says, I'm going to put on the Olympia with Lorimer. He says, will you compete in it? And I said, well, this is something different. I said, yeah, I'll do that. So as a result of the NAVA Universe, I went to the Olympia the first time.
Yeah, you kind of stayed away from the IPV, right, until Arnold invited you to come to the Olympia?
Well, it's not the thing is, it's not that I necessarily stayed away from the IFBB, but being from the South, Louisiana, that's all they had was the AU contest. If you wanted to compete, that's what you had to compete in. The stronghold they had in those days was the shows in New York that Tom Minichiello put on, and maybe a couple on the West Coast. That was it. I don't remember. Or maybe they had a few, like in New Jersey somewhere, or Pennsylvania, but nothing down south.
Yeah, when I was talking about the history of the NAVA Universe with Wayne Galash, that's what we were saying. Like the first 10, 15 years since the NAVA Universe started, that was all there really was. I mean, the IFBB hadn't really come around yet until the 70s. It did get really popular until the 70s.
Well, even you have to remember now, even though Arnold competed in the Olympia, okay, and was starting to win, he'd still always go back to the NAVA Universe.
Yeah.
Because that's where all the credibility was.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it really didn't, and I guess Bill Pearl forced that change. I remember there was an article that came out I'm sure Arnold didn't write it, but somebody wrote it, that everybody was paper tigers. They were afraid to compete against him. And I admit, Bill didn't give a shit about that. But Leo Stern took offense to it. And he says, as he called Weed up, he said, that's bullshit. He says, we'll compete in the NAVA Universe in a fair contest.
Yeah.
Because he knew Arnold had already. So that's when all of a sudden they changed the rules that, you know, Arnold wasn't allowed to compete in that anymore, only in IFBB. That's why. Because no doubt Arnold would have been ready to go to compete in the NAVA Universe, but he couldn't afford to lose his association with the Weeders. And it worked out best for him anyway.
I saw this picture on Facebook recently. It was like a big group picture of all the guys from the old days. You were there, and Frank Zane, I think he was with Christine, and Chris Dickerson, and Arnold was there.
I have that photograph. I know exactly what you were talking about.
Yeah.
Now, the only reason I know exactly what you're talking about, Jim Morris, before he passed away, sent me that photograph, okay? He had managed to get everybody in there, a signature from everybody, and he wanted me to sign it.
Wow.
I said, well, I'll be happy to sue it. I said, send me your copy, and I said, I'll FedEx it back to you. But he was afraid even FedEx would lose it. So I said, well, if you don't want to send to FedEx, I said, he was in, I think, in Santa Monica. I said, either I'll drive up there or you can come to Huntington Beach. But somehow or another, he never did do it. But that picture was taken at a sound stage that I think Don Peters had arranged that.
Okay.
There was a lot of history in that picture. And if I remember correctly, Artie Zeller was the one that took that photograph.
Now, that I thought that was a wedding, but was that the occasion, a party they had for you when you came to California?
Well, I guess it was. I don't remember. I was just saying, hey, there's a party over here. You know, as a matter of fact, even that photographer, Cliff Swan, says you need to go to this party. Don's putting this party on. But as I remember, I guess maybe in honor of me. But I wasn't aware of it at the time.
Yeah, I asked John Balick, and John Balick said, that was a...
Well, John was there because he was sitting right down there in the front row.
And he said that was a party we had for Boyer Co. when he came to California. And I go, wow, isn't that great? That's how great it was back then, that they would actually have a party for someone.
Well, you know what's so sad about that? You look at that photograph. How many of those people have passed away since then?
Yeah.
God, I mean, I was looking at that. I have that picture handy. I was looking at the other day. I said, wow, look, so many of these people are not here anymore.
You know. Well, Jim Morris, like you just said. And Sergio.
Jim Morris, you had Zabo in there, you had Joe Nista in there, his wife is in there, they're both gone. And there's a number of other people in there too.
Yeah.
Cliff Swan, a lot of them.
Don Peters.
Yeah.
Floyd, out of all those NAVA Mr. Universe wins, which one was the most special? Was it your first one?
Oh, the first one, without a doubt. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, well, because like I said, not only the contest, but all the stuff that happened around it made it more interesting and so exciting, you know?
Right, right.
I mean, you could write a book on just what happened. Nothing to do with the contest, just what happened on getting there and what happened after that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's happened to me sometimes, too, though. You want everything to go smooth sailing up into a contest, and sometimes you have these problems. But then sometimes it works out, and you actually win the contest, no matter how many problems you've had before.
Yeah, and also it makes a great memory. Definitely, see, I vividly remember everything that happened in '69. I can barely remember what happened in '73 and '75 because it was kind of uneventful, you know.
Right, right, exactly. All right, Blair. Well, listen, I want to thank you again for joining us on the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
You're always one of my favorite interviews, and hopefully we can have you back on again. And I hope you're doing well out in Huntington Beach.
Maybe the next time, we get together again, I can tell you about some of the exciting things we're doing in the fitness business that definitely is going to make a change. I can say it this much, because all this stuff is actually involved in getting the patents granted, but it'll be life-changing in the fitness business. And I can't really tell you any more about it till I make sure I'm protected with the patents.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm planning on coming out to California. I want to come around Memorial Day weekend. So if you're around,
that would be great.
I'll look
you
up and maybe I can meet you in person.
That'll be fantastic. I look forward to seeing you.
All right, Blair. Thanks again for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, John. Have a great day.
All right. You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to Blair Coe again for joining us. It's always great to talk to Blair. It's always a pleasure. He's always such a great interview. And as I mentioned, next week, we will be joined by John Torelli, who was one of the top bodybuilders in Australia for many years. He won the NAVA Mr. Universe twice, and he competed in the IFBB very successfully for many years. So John had a great physique. We'll get his story next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank our sponsors, Redcon One, Florida Alternative Medicine, and Old School Labs for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We'll see you guys next week. Have a great week, everybody. Take care.